seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 060660, Medical City Dallas versus Carlisle Corporation.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilbreth will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm here today as an emissary for the spirits of Professors Williston, Llewellyn, and Prosser, who all wanted me to tell you that the breach of express warranty claim in this case sounds in contract. In all seriousness, Your Honors, the issue in this case is simple and straightforward. Is a claim or an action for breach of express warranty, to use the words of Section 38.001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, a claim for an oral or written contract such that a prevailing plaintiff may recover attorney's fees? Now, under the facts of this case involving a commercial loss, it's hard to conceive of any answer to that question, but yes. For example, when the court surveys the case law in other jurisdictions, the treatises and the law reviews, the court will see that there is little or no question but that a breach of express warranty claim sounds in contract. The Dallas Court of Appeals, however, held that my client could not recover the attorney's fees it incurred in prosecuting its breach of express warranty claim against the respondent for breach of an express written warranty that was issued in connection with the sale of roofing materials. Now, the Court of Appeals relied primarily on a 1991 opinion by Chief Justice Phillips in a case called Southwestern Bell versus FDP Corp. And it was a case in which this court was not addressing the question here today, whether attorney's fees are recoverable for breach of express warranty. But before I explain why the Court of Appeals' reliance on Southwestern Bell versus FDP was misplaced, I think it would be helpful if I could give the court a few historical facts about Texas law as it pertains to this question. Before 1977, Chapter 38, which was then known as Article 2226, did not provide for the recovery of attorney's fees for breach of contract. That fact, I began my practice in 1990, and that fact came as somewhat of a surprise to me. I didn't know that. For example, in 1973, you have a Texarkana Court of Appeals decision in which the court held that the plaintiff could not recover attorney's fees for breach of a contract to haul mulch. And that was the MC Winters versus Cope case at 498 Southwest 2nd 484. That same year, 1973, the DTPA was enacted, and it provided for recovery of attorney's fees for a claim for breach of warranty. Then in 1977, the legislature amended Article 2226 to provide for recovery of attorney's fees for breach of contract. And 6 years later, the first Court of Appeals held that attorney's fees were recoverable for breach under Article 2226, the predecessor to 38.001, were recoverable for breach of an express written warranty. That case is not cited in our briefs. I think it's an important case for this court to review. It's a case called Porter versus Irvine at 658 Southwest 2nd 711. It's a writ denied case, and it was a warranty, an express written warranty, issued in connection with the sale of a house. And the court held that the DTPA didn't apply because the sale of the house occurred before the effective date of the act. So the court went on to say, but attorney's fees are recoverable for breach of this express written warranty under Article 2226, the same statute we're dealing with here today. Now, the next year, 1984, this court, in my opinion, pretty much stated that breach of express warranty sounds in contract when the court wrote in the La Serra Grain Company case, that is cited in our brief, the court wrote, quote, while express warranties are imposed by agreement of the parties to the contract, implied warranties are created by operation of law and are grounded more in tort than in contract. The next year, 1985, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals held that attorney's fees were recoverable under Article 2226 for breach of a guarantee agreement, which in many respects is very similar to a warranty agreement. And by the way, earlier this year, the Dallas Court of Appeals followed suit and reached the same holding. Breach of a guarantee agreement, you can recover attorney's fees under Chapter 38. That's a case called Smith versus Patrick Trust, an unpublished decision. So that brings me up to 1991 and the Southwestern Bell versus FDP court case. That's the decision that the Court of Appeals relied on for its holding that attorney's fees are not recoverable for breach of express warranty. Now, again, in that case, the court wasn't dealing with the issue we have here today. Rather, the court was addressing the defendant's argument that the plaintiff's claim was for breach of contract, not breach of warranty, didn't rise to the level of breach of warranty, and thus was not actionable under the DTPA. And for that purpose, and that purpose only, Chief Justice Phillips distinguished between breach of contract and breach of warranty. And and this is the troublesome phrase. He stated that they are not the same cause of action. And that's what has led to these Court of Appeals decisions, including the one in our case that brings us here today. But that's not what I am certain that Chief Justice Phillips would be shocked and surprised to learn that that decision and that language is being interpreted as holding that the breach of express warranty doesn't sound in contract for purposes of Chapter 38. What he was explaining was there's a difference between the two causes of action because, you know, breach of warranty occurs when the buyer finally accepts the goods and finds that they're deficient in some respect. Breach of contract occurs when the goods are never delivered, essentially. But the court never held that breach of express warranty doesn't sound in contract. Instead, the court simply explained that only a true breach of warranty claim is actionable under the DTPA. I think distinguishing between breach of contract and breach of warranty for that purpose is akin to distinguishing between fraud and negligent misrepresentation for purposes of, for example, the types of damages that are recoverable, as this court has done in cases like Formosa Plastics and DSA versus Hillsborough. That doesn't mean that both claims don't sound in tort, and it doesn't mean that the proportionate responsibility statute in Chapter 33 doesn't apply to both claims. Likewise, just because there are differences between breach of warranty and breach of contract doesn't mean that breach of express warranty doesn't sound in contract. Yes, as Chief Justice Phillips pointed out in the Southwestern Bell case, the remedies for the two are dealt with in separate parts of the UCC, but that doesn't mean that Chapter 38 doesn't apply to a claim for breach of express warranty. So if a claim for breach of express warranty does sound in contract, then a plaintiff can recover attorney's fees under Chapter 38. So, in short, in this case and in the other cases that the respondents rely on, the courts of appeals were just reading far too much into the language in the Southwestern Bell versus FDP case.
Could this case have been brought under the DTPA?
No, Your Honor, it's probably not apparent in the record, but Medical City would have assets over $25 million. So I think that's why the decision was made not to bring it under the DTPA. That's a nice segue to my other point, and that is that one of the courts of appeals that they rely on, one of the decisions, the court said, well, you can't have a claim for breach of warranty actionable under Chapter 38 because you can recover your attorney's fees under the DTPA, and therefore that would make the DTPA provision meaningless. I really don't understand that assertion. I mean, first, the DTPA says that the remedies it provides are cumulative, and second, when the DTPA was enacted, remember, that was 1973, you didn't have a right to recover attorney's fees under Article 2226 for breach of contract. So there was no way to recover attorney's fees for breach of an express warranty until the DTPA came along. So I would say, and then in 1977, they amended Article 2226 to make attorney's fees recoverable for breach of contract. So I would say, arguably, the legislature has now twice expressed its intent that you recover your attorney's fees for breach of express warranty. Now, there's a distinction here that if the court decides to rule in my client's favor, there is a distinction I think the court may want to make in its holding. Because a claim for breach of express warranty can sound, under some circumstances, in tort. My fifth edition of Prosser and Keaton has an excellent discussion on this point. What he says is that Whether the claim sounds in contract or tort depends on the nature of the damages. So when damages are sought for intangible, as Prosser says, he calls them intangible economic and commercial losses, then you've got a claim for breach of contract. I mean, the breach of warranty claim sounds in contract. When the breach of warranty plaintiff is seeking damages for personal injury or harm to other property, then you have a claim that would sound in tort. And so I think the court, if you rule in my client's favor, you'll want to make that distinction if you don't want plaintiffs to recover attorney's fees in what is essentially a tort action. And I think the easiest way to draw that distinction would be by reference to Chapter 82 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Section 82.001 defines, quote, products liability action as, quote, any action against a manufacturer or seller for recovery of damages arising out of personal injury, death, or property damage allegedly caused by a defective product, whether the action is based in strict tort liability, strict products liability, negligence, misrepresentation, breach of express or implied warranty, or any other combination of theories.
What about the distinction between express and implied warranties? Does the latter still sound in tort principally?
This court has on a number of occasions said indirectly, strongly intimated, and maybe said directly in some occasions, that implied warranty claims sound in tort. Now, I think it's a very interesting issue. A lot of the commentators like to get salacious when they talk about warranty. For example, Prosser called it warranty law is a freak hybrid born of the illicit intercourse between contract and tort law. Another commentator I was reading said he called this cause of action hermaphroditic because of these strange origins that warranty law has. But the courts, as I think Chief Justice Phillips noted in that Southwestern Bell, they've been a little more reluctant when it comes to implied warranties. But this court has said on a number of occasions, implied warranty tends to sound in tort. It has also said on other occasions, I guess, that it's a statutory claim. So I don't think you can say for certain. The commentators, though, tend to treat implied warranty differently and consider it more of a tort concept. When it comes to breach of express warranty, sure, it started off at, it has its roots, its origins in tort law, but over the decades, it has clearly become a claim that sounds in contract. There's some interesting commentary on
that. What does that mean, sounds in contract?
I think it's sort of the, I guess it's, maybe it's the, I'm trying to be scholarly, but it's the scholarly way of saying it's a contract claim. That's what the commentators would say. Well, it sounds in contract, but as an advocate, I say it is a breach of contract claim. It is a contract claim. It mirrors the language of Chapter 38 because if you look at this 20-year membrane warranty that they gave us, that is clearly a contract.
If the manufacturer, which is brought in by, say, a general contractor to put on a roof, where is the contractual relationship between the owner and the manufacturer?
That's a point that they do make in their brief, and it's a point that is dealt with in a couple of ways. First off, if you want to look at it in terms of, if you were asking me, well, where's the consideration for this warranty they gave you? Well, UCC 2-313, comment 7 says, under those circumstances, no consideration is necessary. The other question, a way to look at it is, well, how can, we had no contractual relationship with them, did we? I guess that's the question you were asking. But in the PPG case, Justice Brister cited a case in a footnote. It's very similar. It's a case called U.S. Pipe and Foundry Company versus City of Waco. And there, this court said it was a very similar type of transaction. And this court said, you look through the form to the substance. And in this situation, sure, we had our contract was with Charlie Company, the roofing company. But in that contract, there was called for a warranty on the roofing materials. So this was a part of the bargain. We wanted a warranty on these roofing materials. And we were really doing business with Carlisle through this transaction, through this relationship. And that's what the Supreme Court said in that U.S. Pipe and Foundry Company case. If you really look at the true nature of the transaction, that's what it was. We had essentially a contractual relationship with them. And particularly if you look at this, it's a written contract, the warranty is.
And there's evidence to indicate that your clients inquired about and or relied upon there being an extended warranty?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't have the cite to the clerk's record or the record on that, but I can get it to the court. But it's in the bid document, the bid documents, that we wanted a warranty.
You said there's essentially a contractual relationship, but during the charge conference, didn't you deny that there was any contractual relationship between...
I think there are...
City and Carlisle.
It wasn't me. I wasn't at the charge conference, Your Honor, but I understand the point. And I think back and forth throughout this case, we've been pointing the finger at each other and saying, well, you said it was a contract, or you said it wasn't a contract, and you should be stopped. And frankly, I don't think the court should decide this case on the basis of those sorts of arguments, whether they come from us or the other side. I think the question here is simply, is a claim like this, breach of express warranty, does it sound in contract? Is it a breach of contract claim? And so, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ellerman will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. At the outset of my opposing counsel's argument, he invoked the names of Professor Llewellyn and Prosser and others, so I feel I have to do the same. In the Lacerra Grain case decided by this court a long time ago, the court quoted Professor Llewellyn as saying that to say warranty is to say nothing of legal effect. There are many different kinds of warranties. There are express warranties, implied warranties, warranties of fitness for a particular purpose. There are warranties that are connected to contracts. There are warranties that are actually part of contracts, and there are warranties such as those at issue here, which a manufacturer issues to a purchaser of a product. Those warranties are freely transferable. There's no privity of contract requirement for a plaintiff who holds one of those warranties to sue a manufacturer such as Carlisle. The bottom line here is that the court in this case is being asked to make a decision that a breach of warranty claim in the abstract, or a breach of express warranty claim in the abstract, entitles a successful plaintiff to recover attorney's fees under Chapter 38.
So you concede that some warranties, attorney's fees are recoverable for some breach of some warranty?
I don't know that I would concede that point, Your Honor, and the reason is I don't think that point is even brought to the court today. Here, there was no contract.
No, we're not writing for just your case.
I understand.
I mean, if you gave buyers two options, you can buy a roof that'll last 5 years and that'll cost you $10,000. You can buy one that'll last 40 years and that'll cost you $60,000. I'm going to buy the expensive one. I want it to last. And it lasts 6 years instead of 40. That's not a breach of contract?
Well, that may be if the buyer had a contract with the seller. If the buyer and the seller entered a contract, and sure, I'm certain that happens.
So the difference is if the warranty is in a written or oral contract, then it would be a breach of contract.
I think that's one level of distinction. The other level of distinction is to look at what...
I know they're different cases. I'm just trying to say, do you concede attorney's fees would be recoverable?
Not necessarily, because I think once that is looked at, then a court would also have to look at the factors presented by this court in Southwestern Bell.
How in the world, if I've got two different roofs that cost two different prices because they're going to last two different periods, and I get the expensive one and it doesn't last, how in the world is that not a breach of contract?
If there was a contract between the parties, I think it certainly could be. And I think under that circumstance, a party may be able to sue for breach of contract and breach of warranty or either one.
Who did your warranty go to? Who did you warrant your product to in the writing that you furnished?
That's a good question, Your Honor. The warranty at issue in this case, the 20-year warranty, was issued by Carlisle, my client, to Charlie Company. If you look
look at the warranty.
Didn't reference any in any manner the ultimate consumer?
No, it did not.
Of course, they pass with the goods, that, as we said in PPG.
That's exactly right. Warranties are, like the one at issue here, are transferable. That's
so
one
if,
of.
So if this was the general contractor, then they would be able to get suing because the roof didn't last. They could get attorney's fees.
Well, the that assumes that this warranty was a contract. I haven't seen that Medical City, that Carlisle and Charlie Company were parties to a contract, and I don't know that the record shows that. What this is simply a manufacturer's warranty that was issued to the purchaser, who was Charlie Company. Now, that warranty ultimately ended up in the hands of Medical City, of course, and Medical City sued for breach of warranty. Medical City has never throughout the trial court proceedings argued that it had a contract with Carlisle. And I think even in Medical City's briefing to this court, it acknowledges that the contract that, to the extent there was a contract underlying the facts of this case, that contract was between Medical City and Charlie Company. Carlisle wasn't a party to any such agreement. But what has happened here is Medical City could not sue Carlisle for breach of contract for the reasons we've discussed. Medical City had no contract with Carlisle, therefore it sued on the warranty that was presumably transferred to it from Charlie Company. Medical City, following a successful verdict on its breach of warranty claim, is trying to get its attorney's fees from a statute that applies only to contract claims.
Now, what's the purpose of that statute? What's the purpose of 38001?
Well, one of the stated purposes, and I believe probably the primary stated purpose, is to avoid deterring parties from engaging in litigation because of the costs involved.
So the purpose is to allow attorney's fees when it had not been allowed before in certain circumstances.
In the circumstances delineated in that statute.
And so do you give any import to the provision in 38005 that it's to be construed liberally if there's any question about whether warranties are contracts or contracts are warranties, that to the extent there's uncertainty there, does that drive the analysis in any way?
I think, obviously, we agree that liberal interpretation should be employed. I think what the statute means when it says liberal interpretation is something different than what the court is being asked to do today. In the Doctors Hospital case out of Houston, I believe, which discussed, it's cited in the petitioner's brief, which discussed application of that statute to promissory estoppel claims and held that the statute would not apply to those claims. The court stated that liberal construction does not permit the court to inject language into that statute that's not there. In other words, to say that the statute applies to a promissory estoppel claim when the statute by its express terms applies to a contract claim.
Well, but in order for the buyer to be made whole here, that they had to go through the same elements of proof, whether they were suing for breach of contract or suing for breach of warranty. I mean, you'd agree with that, right?
Well, they had to show that there was a breach of the document that was issued to them, which was a warranty.
And if the proof at trial and all the expenses are going to be the same, then why wouldn't we liberally construe that to allow recovery? There's something unfair. Inherently, if the attorney's fees required to be made whole exceed the amount of the damages, that you wouldn't allow under its liberal purpose to have those recovered.
And the result here may on its face seem unfair, but Chapter 38 applies to contract claims. The DTPA, which we discussed earlier, it allows recovery for breach of warranty claims, not for big companies, that's correct.
If the roof here had fallen on somebody and the product liability claim, that would clearly not be a contract claim. But all they're suing for here is economic loss, right?
Yes.
And economic loss rule says if you're just suing for the damage to the product, you have to sue in contract. And the whole reason for this substantial difference, as I understand it, the whole reason they're moving the restatement of economic harm out of the torts is because economic losses are not torts, they're contracts. And personal injury and other property losses are torts. They're not contracts. And so how can warranty be contract but not a contract?
That may be the general rule, Your Honor, that claims for economic loss generally sound in
contract.
Do you
know of any jurisdiction that doesn't recognize the economic loss rule?
No, I do not, Your Honor. The distinction, I believe, that needs to be made in this case is there may be, as this court recognized in Lacerra and other cases, the general rule may very well be that a warrant, an express warranty, can't exist without a contract. There are cases that have said that. Opposing counsel has briefed those cases and argued those cases today. That may be the general rule. But there's always exceptions to every general rule. And
but
what I
don't understand about that statement is when you say there can be an express warranty without a contract, but isn't an express warranty a contract?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that it is. And I believe the UCC makes a distinction between warranties and contracts in that regard. In Section 2.313, I believe Comment 2, the court states that nothing in the express warranty section of the UCC is intended to disturb the body of law, that express warranties can exist without a contract. And the reason they can exist without a contract is because of the privity issue. We listened to this morning in this court about sales of automobiles. Well, if I purchase an automobile and that comes with a manufacturer's warranty, and then I go and sell that car to somebody else and take it on down the line, that person sells to somebody else and we get to the fifth or sixth seller, well, that person may still have a valid warranty, but that purchaser has no privity of contract with the manufacturer. So for that ultimate purchaser down the line to be able to sue the manufacturer for breach of contract simply flies in the face of contract law. There's no offer, there's no acceptance, there's no agreement.
You think of things like the claim sounds in tort or it sounds in contract. Are you saying that this claim here sounds in tort?
I'm not saying that the claim sounds in tort.
If it doesn't sound in tort and it doesn't sound in contract,
what does it
what
sound,
does it
in?
Sound in?
I don't know. I guess it sounds in warranty, Your Honors. There's simply
no way
that I can fathom you can say the claim sounds in contract when there's no contract in this case. So if the court were presented with a lawsuit, let's say Charlie Company, and I don't know that the record contains a contract between contains the contract between Charlie Company and Medical City, but if two parties to such a contract, if one of the parties sued for breach of warranty, then the court might be able to find that the case is so intertwined with the party's contractual relationship and the terms of that contract, and the warranty may even be part of that contract, that the court could say this is really a contract case. Here we don't have that. There is no contract. There was never even a contract claim.
So the cases, the economic loss rule cases, which are universal in American law, they all say this: if you're suing for the value of the product, even if it's on a warranty, this case sounds in contract. So you can't get mental anguish and you can't get punitive damages. How can it sound in contract for some things and not others?
And is your question? I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, these are not new cases. They've been around for a long time.
Sure.
If you bought a boat and the boat sinks and nobody died and it didn't damage any other property, as the U.S. Supreme Court said a long time ago, your claim sounds in contract. You don't have a strict liability claim. You don't have a tort claim. Your claim sounds in contract. The only thing you can sue for is contract damages. And it seems like that says warranties sound in contract and contract alone.
I've
never heard anyone say something sounded in warranty.
Well, I think generally, as the court recognized in Lacerra, a warranty claim is not independent of a contract. But there is a unique situation, and that's what's presented here, that there is a warranty without a contract. And so I think if the court...
That seems to be fairly standard, especially if you're talking about roofs or products that have a warranty that lasts for a long period of time. Those warranties are going to be transferred. So how is that unique?
Well, I don't know if unique is the right choice of words, but it's different. It's different from the situation contemplated by the court in Lucera. It's different from the line of cases cited by the petitioner regarding other causes of action, such as promissory estoppel, conversion, bailment, et cetera. In every one of those cases, there was a contract between the parties to the lawsuit. Every one of them. And I take issue with certain of those lines of cases, particularly the promissory estoppel ones, as did the court in the Doctors Hospital case out of Houston. Promissory estoppel is not a contract claim. The Fifth Circuit, in holding that Chapter 38 applied to promissory estoppel, relied on the restatement of contracts, which says promissory estoppel is really a contract claim. That's not the rule in the state of Texas.
How about the other cases, conversion and bailment and et cetera, that are pointed out in the brief? All those are wrong as well?
I don't believe that all those cases are necessarily wrong, Your Honor. Those cases are different. They're entirely different. The conversion cases, for example, the Exxon versus Bell case out of Texarkana, states that generally attorney's fees are not recoverable for conversion. It goes on to state that the entire case in that opinion was based on a contract. The Mustang Trading case out of Dallas, which petitioner asserts is a departure from what the court did in this case, also concerned conversion. In that case, the plaintiff sued for conversion and breach of contract. The plaintiff recovered on its claims. There was no statement in the judgment as to how attorney's fees were awarded or on what claim attorney's fees were awarded. There was no statement of facts presented to the Court of Appeals. So the Court of Appeals said, well, we can presume that attorney's fees were awarded for the breach of contract claim. So any discussion of the conversion claim wasn't really particularly relevant there. But in any event, even in that case, there was a contract between the parties.
But every warranty arises from a contract.
Name
one that doesn't.
Well, if there is a product that is sold by a retailer, a consumer probably has a contract when it purchases that product. That contract is with the retailer, not with the manufacturer. The warranty.
Your whole argument is not that there's no contract. It's that you're going back to the days of privity. We don't have privity in that particular contract they're suing on.
Our argument is that there is not a contract because our first argument.
There has to be a contract here. One party sold, you sold a roof to a general, and a general paid you. That's a contract.
I think.
And a general did a contract with the hospital, and the hospital paid the general. We've got at least two contracts here. We don't have, this is not a zero contract case.
And if that is correct, then Medical City.
How could that possibly not be correct? I know you don't.
I'm agreeing with you.
But how could money changing hands in this world not be a contract?
I think it could be, Your Honor, and I agree with
you. If I stole it.
The difference is Medical City couldn't sue to enforce any of those contracts.
Oh, it's just yours is purely a privity argument, not a contract.
So the way to get around that is then just to sue the contractor and let the contractor then bring in the manufacturer.
Potentially, Your Honor, that would be possible, and
then the contractor could recover his attorney's fees, but you couldn't recover yours against the general.
Correct, and I don't recall the specifics of what went on at trial, but the contractor was a defendant throughout the trial of this case, and I don't believe there was any recovery against
the contractor. But how would that make any sense, though, that construct, that the person who's been damaged can't get their attorney's fees, but the general contractor can?
And so that I understand your question correctly, under what theory would the general contractor be recovering its fees?
Breach of contract.
Breach of contract claim against the manufacturer.
Because you're saying they're the only one that has a breach of contract claim. So the general brings in the general. You sue the general and the manufacturer. The general asserts a cross-claim against the manufacturer and says, I want my attorney's fees on the cross-claim. So they get their attorney's fees, but the plaintiff who's been damaged does not get theirs.
That could be a situation that might arise. The fact of the matter, though, is that Chapter 38 applies to contract claims. If those parties that you just described in those circumstances had contract claims and they were victorious, certainly they would have a claim for attorney's fees. This just doesn't fit. And if it doesn't fit, then it's up to the legislature.
Legislature, didn't the statute at one point reference sounds in contract, and then it was codified?
I believe the language used might have been founded on contract, and I think if that's the language, if I'm recalling that correctly, founded on contract presumes that there's a contract, and there may be contracts in certain circumstances, as I discussed earlier. The UCC certainly contemplates that there can be suits for breach of warranty without a contract.
The fact that the consumer is suing you based upon your promise that your product was good for 20 years still does not make it founded on a contract.
I don't believe that it does, Your Honor. I believe that founded on a contract means that there is a contract. A contract requires more than just a promise. A contract requires an offer, an acceptance, a meeting of the minds.
But there was a contract. We've got to agree there was a contract. You sold it at least to the general.
There was arguably a contract between us and the general and between...
You're saying there wasn't a contract?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor.
So there was some contract, as we've just been exploring here earlier. And absent that contract, you would have no liability whatsoever. I mean, this is not a duty imposed by law. It's a promise that your client made when they sold a product.
And although there are contractual relationships, Your Honor, Medical City, under the particular facts of this case, was not entitled to assert a breach of those relationships against Carlisle. Its only claim was breach of warranty. That's been undisputed throughout the litigation of this case.
If the statute still said founded on a contract, would your argument be different?
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The Article 2226 did say founded, suits founded on oral or written contracts. That was the language before. Justice Johnson, your question about the warranty itself and whether it referenced my client, it did indeed. I don't think Mr. Ellerman was anyway misrepresenting what it says, but it does reference our client. It says, it doesn't say issued to or anything like that. It just
certificate,
at the top.
Certificate? Are you talking about a certificate?
It says 20-year membrane material warranty. And then at top it has the Charlie Company of Texas typed with its address on the left side. And then on the right side it says Medical City, Building B, and then gives our address. So it did reference our client.
And that's the certificate issued by Carlisle.
I think it's tab E to our brief. Now, Mr. Ellerman started off by saying that, well, there's all kinds of warranties out there, and I guess he was implying that if you hold that you can recover attorney's fees for breach of warranty, then you're going to be allowing attorney's fees for a bunch of different animals out there. That's not, I mean, we're just asking the court to hold that you can recover attorney's fees for breach of an express warranty involving commercial losses. Again, the distinction I made and suggested to the court, you wouldn't want to allow them for breach of warranty claims that involve tort.
Your argument that it applies just if they sound in contract, not if they sound in tort. The statute does say for an oral or written contract. It doesn't say sound in.
That's correct.
Are we changing the statute?
No, I don't think you are changing the statute, Your Honor, because, again, a claim for breach of express warranty is a claim for breach of a contract. Yes, the warranty concept has changed over the years, but it is squarely now considered by everybody a contract claim. And so you are not
unless
in
there's anyway. Personal injury or property damage, in which case it's not a contract claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. It goes back to the
freak hybrid nature of the claim, but I think there's very little support for any idea that breach of an express warranty that involves commercial loss. I mean, it sounds in contract. It's not a tort. Prosser said it. Prosser and Keaton, I think, does an excellent job of discussing that point. Asked a question about the purpose of Section 38.001, and when I started preparing for this argument, that was one of the first things I wanted to explore because I thought that was an important point. I looked up, I have Farnsworth on contracts, and I wanted to see what he says about why do we have remedies for breach of contract. And the purpose, I think, is, I mean, we need to keep the economy going. If people can't enforce contracts, then the economy will break down. Farnsworth says we need to encourage promisees to be able to be confident to rely on the promisor's promise. And so if you breach of warranties are an integral part of our economy, and if you can't enforce them, you need an incentive to make the promisor comply with the warranty. And that's an incentive that just, I mean, it keeps the economy going. Justice Brister, one point that you raised, I wanted to address another point that I thought about, and it seems that every case that I have worked on probably in the last 10 years has involved a fraud claim. Now, why is that? I think in many instances, a representation could be, the difference between a warranty and fraud is often scienter. And so if you could bring a claim for breach of warranty and recover your attorney's fees, then I think you would have more people bringing warranty claims that ought to be warranty claims. They are warranty claims, not fraud claims, instead of having people trying to bring fraud claims in order to get, I guess, punitive damages. We have way too many fraud claims, and I think if the court says, look, you can recover your attorney's fees for breach of warranty, we'll get a lot of these cases out of the tort system and into the contract system where they belong. So in short, I mean, it's very clear breach of the express warranty in this case was a breach of a contract, and we should recover our attorney's fees. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Counselor. The clause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn court.